right. Perfect. So, well, I'm super excited for this panel. This is something we've been talking about for quite some time. You know, in the world of sort of the aerodigestive world, there's like some of us who seem to get very involved on the cardiac side, some of us who don't. We go to meetings, and at least on the ENT side, we see all sorts of great pictures and videos of slide tracheoplasties and stuff like that. But there's a whole lot of other stuff that goes on up in the cardiac units. So I was really excited to kind of get this group together here. And what I want to do is just spend a little time sort of walking through, you know, what does aerodigestive care look like for this population? So we're very lucky to have our esteemed panelists here. So Naomi Lowe, so she joins us from our institution, so down at Rady's in San Diego, and she'll be able to kind of give us the whole feeding approach as a speech pathologist. Coming to us live from India is Nikhil Rao, and we'll get her up on the screen when her time comes through here. Doug joins us from over at Stanford, and then Robin Dieterding here. Wonderful person, and she's here to help us put us right, because here we are going to be talking a bunch of feeding, and here we're making sure we're not trashing the lungs too much. So I want to start off with yet another deep, profound statement: aerodigestive care is highly complex. Agreed, right? Yeah, heart defect care—that's pretty complex stuff too. So what happens when we mix these things? Is it the perfect aerodigestive patient? I think so. And I think that's really what I want to do. I'm going to present a patient to get us off and rolling here, but really want to talk about it from a sort of continuum of care and sort of how we approach these children. It's case-based, but not really. This is more like a story as we walk our way through. So this is pretty straightforward in the terms of cardiac surgery. 2-month-old, prenatally diagnosed single ventricle. And so term birth and had a normal microwave, had a whole genome without notable variants, kind of following the normal sort of a plan, had a Norwood at 1 week of life. There are, of course, early concerns along the way that there was GI issues kind of making its way through. We ended up with a nasal gastric tube for feeding, on supplemental oxygen, made it out to the outpatient world, and is now in the outpatient monitoring setting. So here we are. So we're now a couple months in. We've had our Norwood. We're in that precarious interstage position of cardiac surgery. And these kids roll in. They're all kind of noisy. And of course, they have the hoarse cry that goes along that, because I think, as most people know, a Norwood procedure is kind of as you are all right around the nerves. Minimal oral feeding, not surprising. Being fed through the nasogastric tube has actually been refusing. And when you read the evaluations, you would say immediately coughs after holding your breath with only one suck, swallow, breathe cycle. Okay. Currently being feeding with fortified breast milk through the NG tube. So of course, there's a flexible laryngoscopy along the way. One of the residents that they went by dropped a scope and said there's an immobile left vocal fold. So goal is to follow the typical pathway for a single ventricle and aim for the bidirectional gland at around 6 months. So when it comes to the feeding side, and we talk about this kid who's noisy breathing, gurgling, choking, refusing to feed, is it the heart? Now, we know the cardiologists say it's not the heart. It's not the heart, it's something else. It's never the heart, right? So now I'd say that all these factors play together. Clearly, we're having good surgery along the way. Things are getting connected where we need to be, but is it really the heart? And so I think this is where our role comes in. And this is where we can say, okay, We can agree that the heart is involved, but there are things that we can do to help. And so as we go through today and sort of talk about the different sort of implications along the way and things that we think about, I really want to think about cardiac diagnosis. So clearly this is going to matter. If you're a single ventricle versus something versus a VSD, clearly there's going to be a difference in sort of what that pathway entails. Where are you in the staging process? Are you waiting your Glenn? That's a pretty unstable sort of time period. Versus are you post-Glenn? Have you had your Fontan? Or is it just a single surgery? You're kind of moved through. What are the genetics? Because clearly these kids there's lots of syndromes we need to be thinking about, and like the implications of 22q11, trisomy 21, you name it. The cardiopulmonary balance. I think that is something that I can tell you, like in the, so from a standpoint, you start focusing, as we talk about aerodigestive, looking at the big system, looking at everything together, certainly that balance, we know it's going to be dynamic. It's going to be changing. what other things are going on? You know, what other concomitant pathology? And I think as we talk through the day, this is really, I want to keep these things in mind. And I don't think we're going to walk out of here with saying, this is what you got to do every single time, but it helps move us along. So with that, I'm going to have Naomi come up and tell us a little bit about the clinical evaluation of feeding.
All right. So I work with the Arrow team and also in the CTICU. And a lot of times these patients, the lines between Arrow and cardiac get blurred. And so I get involved very early on. They place auto orders for us right from the beginning. So since we're going through a hypoplast case, we would get orders as soon as they're born, a few hours in. As soon as they're physiologically stable, they're usually started on TPN. A lot of times they'll set a goal, like a volume goal for PO/TPN. We'll go in and evaluate them for pre-feeding skills, even feeding skills. We see them pre-op, post-op, inpatient, outpatient, pretty early on and frequent involvement, especially during the early interphase. And usually between birth and until they get their Glenn and then after Glenn, we're pretty involved. So I'm just going to go through kind of what I would go through with these patients. Pre-op, our pre-op goals are different than post-op. Pre-op, I need to establish a baseline. So are they rooting? Are they sucking? Are they swallowing their own secretions? We usually do some pretty conservative trials. We might do super slow flow depending on what respiratory support they're on and how stable they are on. We're going to do some conservative trials, determining the safety of their feeds with known physiological limitations. We know endurance isn't going to be there, but we want to give them the opportunity to have a positive feeding experience and the opportunity to start establishing their motor plan for eating before they go through surgery. It also gives us a chance to establish a relationship and some rapport with the family, and parent involvement and bonding is always a goal. I think that parents at this stage, when some of them have most of them prenatal diagnosis, but some don't, and they kind of don't know what they're getting themselves into. And a lot of times we see these parents and they're like, they have this idea of, oh, I'm going to breastfeed my baby, I'm going to be all natural. And then they come in, they're like, wait, why is this not happening? And so just getting them involved, some of them are afraid to touch their babies, afraid to hold their babies. Different nursing staff with umbilical catheters, some nursing staff don't even feel comfortable, but at our institution, most of them, at least our core staff, will be willing to let the parents hold the babies. And so trying to get them on board, the postpartum depression, they're at risk for that at this stage, especially if they don't get involved and start actively doing things. And sometimes they feel helpless, like they don't know what to do. And so letting them know that feeding is a progression and a continuum, and if they want to breastfeed, getting them to realize the importance of familiarizing their baby to the environment, doing skin-to-skin contact, even maybe latching and doing some dry breastfeeding, but letting them know that, you know, it doesn't happen overnight, but there are things they can do, and giving the parents things so they feel a little bit more control, so that I've had parents come in and they're like, this is the first time I've held my baby, and they start crying. And so trying to get them involved in those feedings early on, really, that's super rewarding for me when the parents are like bonding and crying and involved. So we try to get them involved in the feedings as early on as we can, training them. Of course, I have to get my hands on getting them pumping if they want to breastfeed. A lot of times they haven't pumped, they're stressed, they don't have milk supply. So helping them with that and the pre-feeding skills. So I threw kind of the outline of our evaluation that we use for our notes in here. I won't bore you with it. It's kind of like, I write my notes, they're boring, no one reads them, but I throw them in there anyway. So there you go. So, and I'm just briefly gonna mention that we use NEARS. I'm not gonna go into it in great depth for sake of time, but we have both cerebral and renal NEARS that monitor, it looks at oxygen perfusion. And sometimes when their other vitals are stable, the NEARS, you can see some drops when there's early stressors. And so it gives us kind of a physiological indication of stress in some of these newborns that, yeah, there are stress cues, but they might not show us outwardly all their stress cues. And so it gives us some of those indications, and we can use that to evaluate how they're doing and how we should progress with feeding to give them a positive experience. And so when I'm assessing them pre-surgery, of course, I'm looking for changes I know that their vitals are not the typical vitals that you would see in a healthy infant, but I'm looking for changes. Does their heart rate go up? Do we see that they're more tachypneic than they are at baseline? So our babies, 80, we're like, okay, that's good. But when you're breathing 80 times a minute, it's hard to hold your breath so that you can swallow milk. And so then when you hold your breath and you've got to breathe faster to get that oxygen that you lost when you held your breath, you get a little more tachypneic, and then taking those breaks. And so kind of balancing this out and figuring out where they are. My colleagues and I, during this conference, we've all started referring to we're like, how are you doing? They're like, I'm comfortably tachypneic. So that's our new saying, is they're comfortably tachypneic. And that's what we hope for, is to get them at a state where we can do a little bit of PO, maybe with an ultra preemie, where they get a little drop, they hold their breath for a minute, we pace them, use the techniques so that they can have a positive experience. So we're looking at their stress response and stability. Of course, we'll start off with just non-nutritive positioning, see how they handle that, and then move on to feeding. So then we get a good baseline. They go in for their surgery, usually the first week of life. So we have to get in there quickly because things move fast. And then post-op, they put orders in for us immediately afterwards. As soon as they're extubated, we're watching them. We're involved in secretion management. Are they swallowing? Even passies, sometimes I'll see a baby who, the nurse is like, they're gagging on passies, trying to figure out why. Is it because they're guarding, they have secretions, they're not swallowing, and we need to help them work on getting those down? So we'll look for post-surgical changes and then ask ourselves, why did they have these changes? Reestablishing the motor plan, optimizing their feed experience again. And then we know they're at high risk for aversion at this state. So we're trying to give them positive feeding experience while minimizing aversive risks. And we're also looking at daily changes. The culture at our institution in cardiac ICU, we don't do a lot of modified bariums. There are a couple reasons. One, most of our babies after surgery, we expect a little bit of aspiration here and there. And so we're really just trying to minimize the risk or the harm from that happening, and to do a study and see that they aspirated once and then I cut them off is not necessarily, we have to consider the risks of cutting them off from feeding and the experience feeding when from day to day they're going to improve after surgery. At least that's our hope. They also don't like to send them off the unit. Also, we have to weigh the risks and benefits of aspirating. And so we're looking at, okay, do we see signs of aspiration? Why? And then does it change from day to day? And what can we do to minimize that and minimize the aversive risks? So of course, after surgery, I'll do another oral motor exam. I'm looking for things like symmetry. None of us like to admit that sometimes neurological impairments happen. It's rare. And most of the time we're like, no, that wasn't. But that's one of the things we're looking for is, do we see asymmetry that wasn't there before? We know what structure looks like going into surgery, so we can assess that coming out. Looking at secretion management, state, physiological stability, interest, alertness. Of course, after surgery, when they have chest tubes and they're trying to manage pain and they may have GI symptoms, it's a whole different ball game than prior to surgery. So there's a lot going on. We're assessing the whole infant, their coordination of suck, swallow, breathe, but also we'll feed on levels of respiratory support, like CPAP, high flow. So can they coordinate with that? Are there things we can do to let them still have a positive feeding experience? Are they in pain and that's limiting their feeding? We expect them to have chest congestion. If they have chest congestion and they're in pain in the coughing and then they associate with the feed, they might shut down and not eat. And so trying to minimize that, getting a respiratory therapist in, getting them suctioned before we do the trials. If their mouth's full of secretions, getting either suctioning that or stimulating them to get them to swallow that before we even introduce the bottle. So there's a lot going on. So we also, after surgery, we're also using it's a patient-driven model where the patient's telling us both clinically and through monitoring with NEARS whether they're ready for this and what we can do safely. And then we make recommendations, train the family so that they can be involved and do this and nursing. So here you can see an infant that we got in position doing some non-nutritive sucking, and NEARS are at 75, stable, close to average. And then we introduced the bottle and NEARS dropped a little, but within the acceptable range. So we try not to go more than 10. but here they dropped a little bit. It's acceptable. We'll try to implement all the strategies to keep them in that acceptable range where they're still not stressed and having a positive experience. So all the strategies that we try during our interventions, positioning, flow rates, pacing, thickening if appropriate, if there's concern for neck, obviously the team would be involved in making those decisions on whether to trial thickened or not. And then sometimes just alerting and regulation, especially when they're withdrawing, training the parents is a dance between, you know, waking them up and then swallowing them and then unswaddling and then doing this kind of dance to get them going. So then we also see them outpatient when they're in this interphase between the Norwood and the Glen. There's a high mortality rate. So we see them weekly in the outpatient clinic. And if there's any problems, they'll admit them. During this, I'm kind of skipping down to the bottom. The main goals during this stage is physiological stability and growth. But those are the main goals because they got to grow, they got to get their Glen. You got to keep them alive. But then I'm always looking at another goal, that this is a critical period where their suck is going to become integrated. So they're born with the suck reflex. You stick something in, they suck. But if they have a bad experience, by the time they get their Glen, it's right around when they lose that reflexive sucking and it becomes volitional. And babies who don't have a good experience, or they don't ever have that experience where they get to learn how to do this, it's really hard to teach them the motor plan. And if they've been forced to eat or had a bad experience along that way, that's when you see them shut down and refuse to eat. And in my opinion, after the Glen, when they have Glen head and they're a hot mess, it's really hard to get them feeding if they haven't had a strong, good motor plan and good experience up to that point. So during our interphase outpatient, we have the home monitoring program clinic. They come once a week. And we also put in referrals to me outpatient so that I can give them more than the clinic, especially if they go home with an NG, which a lot of them do. And I can do even more support outpatient with them. And we're just basically looking at the safety of feeds, giving them opportunity for positive feeding experience, doing a lot of training with the families, monitoring growth and stability. So it's very collaborative with the dietitian, so with RD, with the doctors. We're going, okay, how much do they grow? Do they gain 20 grams a day? Okay, a lot of them are unfortified. Can we let them breastfeed once a day and then bring it back next week and see if they gain still? And then we'll do twice a day. And so there's a lot of kind of moving pieces and seeing how it worked and doing a lot of family education, training. It's not easy to feed a lot of these babies. And then if they're not progressing, like our case, we need to do further diagnostics and figure out why. So there's a lot of different pieces to the puzzle of what could be going on when they're not progressing with feeding. And a lot of times we wait and inpatient, we expect them to recover, but then we have to look at, okay, what is it? Is it work of breathing? Is it vocal fold mobility? Which of these has a bigger impact on feeding? The work of breathing, with work of breathing, it's gonna be hard to coordinate. You're stopping your breath to swallow when you already have retractions at baseline. But then, so that's going to impact your feeding. And so we might try to implement some strategies there to see if we can compensate for that. And then vocal full mobility is going to impact swallowing and airway protection. But trying to separate all of these different pieces and figure out which ones are impacting the infant is what we're continuing to do outpatient and in the clinic. And so for we're always listening to voice. That's one of the first things I do after surgery. I go in and I go, oh, the babies cry. It's so great. And the nurses, I look at me like I'm crazy. And I'm like, listen to their cough. And they look at me like, I'm like, it's so strong. But I'm always asking the parents, like, what does their cry sound like compared to before? And the parents, get them on board. Okay, listen to their cry. Report back to me tomorrow. And they're like, their cry's getting stronger. I'm like, great. So we expect daily improvement. If we see overt signs and symptoms of aspiration or they're not progressing, they keep delatching, they hold their breath, they're protecting, then we might suspect left side of vocal fold paralysis in this case, because we've got that recurrent laryngeal nerve that wraps down around the aorta. When they rebuild that, I don't know what happens to it, but it gets messed up. And so depending on the position, if it's paralyzed, the position can impact feeding. Some babies figure it out, but we may need to do some further diagnostics to determine whether we might need to do further diagnostics outpatient if we don't see progression. Because as they mature and get more practice, they should get better and better. As long as cardiac function's stable, which we're always looking for sweating during feeds. And that's something that we play a role in too. If we see that they're struggling more to feed where they weren't before, they're working harder to breathe, they're sweating, we'll let the team know. And it's a collaborative role. But if they're not progressing, we may need to do some further investigation with objective studies. And so this is where I'm going to hand off.
Thank you so much, Naomi. So I think, you know, as you, basically what you're saying, there's a lot going on, right? And so, and I think that's really what the key to all this is, sort of having that team approach and being able to work and being proactively thinking. And how are we going to get these kids? Because like you say, it's not like you get the gland and they're fixed, right? So I think that, you know, one of the things I do want to just kind of posit to everybody is, so you brought up the point about NEARS. And so NEARS is kind of an interesting thing that some people buy into, some people don't. Some RCTICU buys into it wholeheartedly. So every kid's got NEARS on for pretty much everything that gets done. So it gives us the opportunity, just out of curiosity from the panel, do they use NEARS in your CTICUs?
So I don't know. We've got two SLPs, I thought, up here, but from our center. But the OT group deals with a lot of our post-cardiac patients for swallowing and feeding. I don't believe they use NEARS for that purpose, but NEARS is applied for other purposes within our CVICU.
Yeah. How about you, Nikhila?
We don't use it at this time. I don't believe there's any, we've talked about it, but I don't think there's any thought of including it yet. I know you guys have really, we've had some conversations about this because I think one of the things that's tough is, just what are cues we can use. And sometimes it's just not so easy in this population. So it's certainly something that is interesting to consider for sure.
Yeah, it's been kind of an interesting road as we've been using it, and just the information that we gain from it is actually it seems to be correlating.
Yeah, it does seem to correlate, but I do notice a lot of times just the infant's state and regulation. So if they're upset and crying and because they just, I don't know, had something done to them, diaper change, something traumatic like a diaper change. I see the NEARS drop, and then sometimes if feeding's going well, I'll watch the NEARS go back up to their average when they're calm and comfortable and feeding well, which is, I think, in itself interesting to see we're always looking for that drop. Like, are they stressed? Is it dropping? But I see the reverse happen a lot with good feeds.
Yeah, I think it's simply a tool. And I think that's just part of like many of these things, which does get us into instrumental studies and sort of the utility of using video fluoroscopies versus fees. And instead of spending a whole lot of time watching a fees here, why don't we go ahead and we're going to go move on to live from India. Where, what's it, midnight or so there right now, Nikhila?
That's 1 a.m.
All right. Well, thanks for staying up for us. I'm going to stop sharing the screen here and we'll let you take over.
Okay. Thank y'all. I feel fortunate to talk about two things that I care a lot about, which are fees and cardiac population. So I couldn't say no to this opportunity, even if it is in the middle of the night. So I'm going to talk a little bit about fees-directed therapy. And although we're talking about this primarily in the cardiac population, it is certainly applicable to other, to really any dysphagia populations. But I'll kind of talk about why I really like it in particular in this population. Just my disclosures are here. Okay, so I think some of these things, people know these things, but I'm just going to quickly say, why I love fees. Obviously, the radiation is not present as it is in video fluoroscopic swallow studies, so I can keep going for as long as possible and repeat as many times as needed, as long as the caregiver is in agreement. You know, in these cardiac kids, it's actually super helpful because of the length of time that you can keep going. We've had 7, 10, 15-minute fees. Of course, my arm is going numb by then, but we're getting great information because of allowing the child to fatigue, and that can really help drive some of the decision-making. It's great to be able to show the caregiver's anatomy. And, this is what I'm going to talk about here today a little bit. I feel like it helps me better predict which patients might be more likely to benefit from surgery and what site. And we can counsel the families better. In my mind, for those people who do surgery for sleep apnea, also I kind of think of a fee as similar to a sleep endoscopy, because we're getting as close to, assessment of what the larynx and the pharynx are doing in a physiologic state, as opposed to just while we're just looking at it, when it's not doing the things that it's supposed to be. And then again, like I said, evaluating endurance and fatigue is very important in this population. I will frame this by saying that we have our aerodigestive clinic. And then last year, I actually talked about, we call it AeroLite, which is a dysphagia management clinic. But I bring this up because we are very much a pro-feeding program. And it was so nice to hear the team from Rady just say that too, that, you know, we want to do whatever we can to keep the kids eating. And so sometimes the fees, you know, passing and failing in a swallow study is just a terrible term to say that the patient passed or failed. There's so much nuance to it. And I feel like the fees can let us evaluate certain other aspects that can be complementary to the video fluoroscopic swallow studies. Okay, let's just clarify. Is it safe in the congenital heart population? There are two older, a little bit older studies. I say there's from 17 and 19 in out of the cardiac literature. And then most recently, out of Northwestern, Dr. Schroeder has been incredibly, instrumental in popularizing fees and has really written a lot about it. But this study he recently published demonstrated that, you know, it's feasible in patients with who've undergone congenital heart surgery. So we know it's safe. And it, you know, it's a good tool to use again in this population. So I also think about this, is, you know, when we think about the congenital heart surgery population, we are often talking about whether or not the vocal fold is motion is impaired. But we also know it's not simply about whether or not the vocal fold movement is normal or not. A systematic review that we did some years ago demonstrated that a high number of patients, even with normal vocal fold motion, end up having feeding issues and have dysphagia, and recovery of vocal fold motion does not necessarily correlate with improvement in dysphagia. I think Dr. Ankaswan from Texas Children spoke earlier at the meeting, and she and I always had this debate. She said, I don't think that the vocal fold is the primary driver. She always says, I think it's bad brain when they have issues with feeding. Now, I think that that's a point of debate, and I do think the vocal fold plays a role, but there are many, it's such a complex process, swallowing is such a complex process that the fees to me is so key in looking at all those other aspects in addition to getting information about the vocal fold movement. And actually, this is a study out of Texas Children's from last year that basically showed that whether or not vocal fold movement impairment is present, there are similar rates of oral and pharyngeal dysphagia and laryngeal penetration, a little bit different in tracheal aspiration and specifically saline aspiration. But frankly, it's high rates either way. So again, the fees can show some more detail of the laryngeal and pharyngeal function in addition to any radiologic studies that are done. All right, so another reason to choose fees, even babies with congenital heart disease should breastfeed if possible. There are good data that demonstrate that breastfeeding, at least, you know, direct breastfeeding obviously would be ideal, but at least offering breast milk or human milk is beneficial in recovery, decreases the risk of necrotizing enterocolitis, improves improves time to PO intake. And this is a recent study at the Michigan group using the NPC-QIC registry that demonstrated that high-duration human milk intake, as well as direct breastfeeding, leads to improvement in outcomes. So, you know, in many cases, if we can allow a patient to directly breastfeed, that is beneficial, and this is where fees can be helpful there. Okay, so in my, at least my surgical brain, I kind of think of dysphagia as six surgical targets for, you know, I'm generalizing here, but I think about the tongue, so ankyloglossia, I think about tonsils plus or minus adenoids. I think about the supraglottis, laryngeal malacia, laryngeal cleft, vocal full movement impairment, and then if there's cricopharyngeal issues with the CPA calasia. And so if I see something like nasopharyngeal regurgitation, I might think about impaired base of tongue movement, which may be because of a tethered tongue with the lingual frenulum, or if I'm not getting complete velopharyngeal closure because the tonsils are really big. If I see penetration of liquid over the tip of the epiglottis and have impaired epiglottic inversion, well, that might say, okay, because of the way the area epiglottic folds are situated, perhaps the epiglottis can't actually flip over, and I might do something like a limited supraglottoplasty. And so fascinating to see, you know, intraretinoid penetrations at least make me feel a little more comfortable when I go to the operating room and say, okay, I think there's going to be improvement when I inject this or I fix it because I saw that happen. Now, you know, we know that some of the findings that we see these kids can be under stress during the fees and whatnot. So it's not exactly a perfect reflection of swallowing. But again, this gives me kind of I feel a little bit more comfortable in making some of these surgical decisions. Again, if I see a lot of residue, we're talking about potentially moving forward with therapy to strengthen oral pharyngeal musculature, potentially needing an MRI. And again, we've seen lingual frenotomy, just again, with the base of tongue movement being impaired. If we see penetration due to liquid, I've seen with a retinoid mucosal redundancy, the liquid actually kind of being dragged into the larynx, well, then I would consider doing a supraglottoplasty. And then if you see things like penetration or aspiration after some time with fatigue, with decreased endurance, seeing premature spillage, seeing delayed initiation of swallows, those would all suggest that more conservative therapies that were discussed previously would be beneficial as your first line of treatment. And so I'm just going to show a couple of feeds here. I'm going to see if I can get this to a good spot to where I'm going to mute it here so you don't have to hear this poor child intermittently being very upset. But what you're going to see here in a moment is, let me see if I can get to a better spot. I believe this is the one. Okay, this is one where the patient just had premature spillage, but did not appear to actually aspirate. We didn't see anything come back up. This patient had aspirated on a video fluoroscopic swallow study. Here you can see, you know, the child is crying and is initiating whenever they're not actively crying in that moment. But what we never see is it actually going down into the larynx or bubbles suggesting that it came back up. So this actually gave us confidence to allow this child to take PO and be closely monitored in feeding therapy. And actually, see that kid, in that moment, the child was extremely upset with us, and we ended up using a syringe in that moment. But again, you know, it at least gave us confidence to say, okay, you can try, and we will follow up with another fees as opposed to getting another video fluoroscopic swallow study. This second example I like because it actually shows an anatomic issue that we ended up taking the patient to the OR for. And what you see here is you can see the tonsils actually here obliterating the vallecula. And you're also seeing a lot of nasopharyngeal regurgitation. That's why my camera is getting all cloudy. And the liquid doesn't have anywhere to go. You know, it's not abnormal to see initiation start in the vallecula, but when it's obliterated by the tonsils like that, everything is just spilling over. And so this kid actually ended up going to the operating room and getting a tonsillectomy, adenoidectomy, and I believe also actually had an intraretinoid injection. But we saw significant improvement in timing and premature spillage and eventual resolution of the dysphagia. So all this is to say that I think a fees is complementary to the video fluoroscopic swallow study and is definitely feasible in the cardiac population. I feel like it helps me better predict which interventions may have a higher chance of success. And it's helpful in counseling caregivers, particularly these high-risk patients. We can avoid, you know, unnecessary anesthesia if possible, as well as weigh the risks and benefits of advancing feeds in this particular population. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Nikhila. I think it's such a great, as you sort of like lay out all the reasons to do feeds. I think it's one of these things that we go to, particularly in this population, because we know we're going to be kind of chasing ourselves to some degree. We want to do repeat studies. So I think one question I kind of pose out there too, we do a fair amount of feeds in the acute period up in the ICUs. Is that common practice across your guys' institutions?
Yes.
We do as well, especially if we're already going to be looking for vocal fold issues, or if the patient is a noisy breather or whatnot, if you're going to be scoping them, not a bad idea to feed them at the same time as long as they're stable. That's our take.
I think there are certain times where a video fluoroscopic swallow study is the obvious answer, and most patients fall somewhere in between. There are many times where we're going to be looking anyway at the larynx, and we try and combine. We have not had major safety issues, as was brought up by you, Nikhila, in the very sick cardiac population.
Yeah, I think that's one of the things that does come up is like this interstage population is how much do you push or not push? And I think that's, we've had some pushback within our own unit. And I think there's a certain degree of coordination that has to happen with that.
Well, you also have rotating teams with different philosophies, I think, in many ICUs. You know, we have attendings who will come on and have one global care plan, and then maybe that will change slightly if somebody else comes on. I don't know if you've ever seen that, but it happens at our institution. I think that in the interstage kids, you know, you've got pre-Glenn physiology. You may not do anything with the data. So if I don't need to see the larynx and the patient's stable otherwise, and you're not going to feed the kid no matter what we see, it doesn't really matter if I put a scope down there. It depends on kind of the fear level of, you know, the kid's overall physiology. And some of these kids are far from right.
Yeah. And I will say we have a policy in our unit of the attending has to be there for any of these procedures, just because, you know, these kids can decompensate quickly. So that's the one caveat I would add.
I'm thinking of a couple cases, one where every time she'd sneeze or cough her NG up, she'd brady and fall apart and threaten to die. And so they were like, no fees. Let's just no fees, but no feeding either. So, and now I think she's how old, a year, and not eating, and got a G-tube, but it was necessary to keep her alive. So same, I think it's case by case. We do a lot of these, but not on everyone.
And I think, Doug, you bring up a great point. But if you're not going to do anything with it, then why would you do it?
Right.
Great. All right. Well, so speaking of which, since we're talking about vocal fold paralysis, is I think something that definitely always comes up in this population, and we'll move on to have Doug come talk to us a little bit about that.
All right, so this is one of those talks where you can shut off most of your cortex and just rely on your brainstem to stay vertical. And you don't even have to do that. It won't hurt my feelings. I don't have anything to disclose. I think in the heart world, you know, they're in there attaching the diddle die do to the damned if I know. And the biggest part of the operation is not, we got to protect this cord, we got to protect this cord, we got to protect this cord. They're doing something much, I don't want to say more important in this room, but in the reality, them getting the kid's heart right is actually a big deal. And a lot of the kids that come to our institution are patients who are critical and have either been evaluated at other institutions and sent home to with no care, or patients who have been born with us for the purpose of having a complex heart repair. But when I walk in the room and I see Bovi settings like this, you know, it kind of makes me chuckle a little bit, because, you know, around that nerve, it won't tolerate it. Most of the time, they're not snipping the nerve in half. And in our institution, if they do, they will tell us, which is very good. They don't have any qualms of saying, yeah, I did all of this and the nerve's out and there you go, deal with it. But they're honest and they don't mind me scoping patients and finding out if the vocal fold is intact or not, mobile or not, because they want us to know and do what's right for the kid. We know that a lot of this is traction, some of it's thermal. The actual transection is rare, but it's also very expensive. In the adult population, you have this problem. You don't need a lot of resources. These are patients who've swallowed, get their thyroid out. It's not too expensive. And the neonate with a congenital heart problem who has this, it can be quite costly. And the data has shown this just with looking at non-commercial payers. We've got a huge gap in what we do about this. There's a very poor, high efficacy, low cost solution for vocal fold immobility in children. Thank you. So, and you know, the truth of the matter is, if somebody kind of finds this solution, then let me know before it goes public. Now I can't click it. Thanks for nothing, Brigger.
Now we can see the screen.
I think so, a little bit of a delay. All right, so for our patient flow, you know, we have patients who come out of cardiac surgery and, you know, they may or may not have been feeding before the cardiac surgery. This may be a patient, as was described by Brigger, where the kid is operated in the first week of life, unlikely doing a lot by mouth before that, quite sick both before and after surgery, but not all patients are like this. And in the heart world, there's a wide variety of swallow function following surgery. And so a clinical swallow evaluation, I do think it's useful. I know some of the Boston data shows that it's probably not of great benefit, but we do have our providers, our swallow therapists, go by the patient and actually evaluate them. We're usually consulted primarily if there's a fees required or if we're concerned about whether or not a vocal fold is immobile. We do not always do a VFSS, but occasionally that is done. If there's an operative intervention, such as a vocal fold injection laryngoplasty, and we feel that that's appropriate and safe, and parents are on board knowing that this is not the only thing that causes swallow dysfunction in all children, and patients with totally normal larynx, as mentioned by Nikhila, can still have swallow problems, then we will inject, and then we will evaluate them again afterwards. And we follow them for quite some time if they're local, and otherwise we keep in touch with the home institutions as much as possible. We also have this is a very, I'll send you guys this slide if you want it, but for our kids who have surgery on or around the aortic arch, we have really protocolized evaluation for these kids, both by the OT group, speech therapy, once they're in our voice and swallow clinic. Our inclusion criteria are very strict. We don't want kids who are super preemie and have a lot of other reasons for having swallow dysfunction. The location of the surgery has to be very specific, and then we decide who is getting an injection in or not, and we follow them. When I'm diagnosing vocal fold immobility, however, I do this awake, and I would strongly suggest, and this is just the way I was trained and what I believe, but that this is the way you make the diagnosis. Whether you're good with ultrasound or use a flexible laryngoscope, I think you could argue that both are in the correct hands, very effective. But if you tell me about how the vocal folds move when you're under anesthesia, then you're at least going to lose a little bit of street cred from me. If you have one side of the vocal fold that's not, or one vocal fold that's not moving well, I think if you're very healthy in a sense that you're not aspirating, you have a strong voice, and that we're not going to make many changes based on going to the OR for an injection, then I will frequently just follow up in the outpatient clinic and make that decision again on an ongoing basis. If you're too sick, and again, cardiac disease does not mean you can't go to the OR by any means. But if we feel like you are unsafe and the risk benefit does not pan out for you to go for an injection, then we don't offer it. However, we're spoiled. We've got great anesthesiologists. We have a great cardiac teams, and they usually do not have any problems with us taking some of the sickest kids back for a quick injection. It takes us 2 or 3 minutes, plus or minus some epi, and back up to the CVICU. We looked at quite a few patients under 18 years of age a couple of years ago with one of my partners, Kara Meister, just to kind of show what we've been doing with our injections over a period of time when I started and really began doing this there. And again, an injection is not a complicated procedure. I think the biggest thing is deciding whether or not it's indicated, and making sure that you understand that a small larynx is different than a large larynx, which is not difficult to understand if you've seen them both. We had 41 patients in this cohort. 46% of them were under 18 months of age. Most of them were cardiac kids. And we showed that you could have improvement in your feeding regimen postoperatively, specifically if you had the ability to feed well before surgery and you came in, you got your cord knocked out, now you're not feeding well, you're aspirating on swallow study, you're probably going to benefit from that injection. We also showed that if you have an injection earlier on, we seem to have a better ability to liberalize the diet than those patients greater than 6 months post-injury to injection. And I think the reality is 3 months is probably more accurate in our more recent data. It came up After this, you know, we had patients under 18. Some of, you know, we had 46% under 18 months, but everybody was asking me, well, what about these little babies? It's very dangerous. We don't inject them. Everything's really small. Does it even help? And I had been injecting the young kids for a while, and I felt anecdotally that it did help. And just to show you, this is who I'm talking about. One of our residents, finally, he's one of those guys who just gets things done. And I said, you know, I keep getting this injection. It'd be nice to hear about whether or not these injections in kids under 1 year of age are actually benefiting with some solid data. And he looked at that. I'm not going to show you everything here, but I'll give you kind of a once over of what we looked at. All kids who were under a year of age at the time of injection were evaluated. They all had their swallow studies and flexible laryngoscopy to confirm the vocal fold immobility. And we had pre and post-operative swallow data available. Of the 49 patients who underwent injection laryngoplasty, there were 9 patients who were sick enough that they weren't going to advance their diet. Now, some of those kids, we were actually asked to inject because they were aspirating fulminantly and they thought maybe it would help. I would say in a subset of those 9, it did help. But looking at the 40 kids who actually had potential for diet advancement, 5 of the patients were on an oral diet preoperatively. 4 of those patients had improvement in the consistency or the volume, and 1 of them did not. Of the 35 who were really NPO before the injection, 32 advanced to an oral diet and 3 remain enterally fed. This is an inpatient cohort. So it's not like they went out of the hospital and we saw them a month later and they were just doing better, because I think there's a lot of things that can confound just with time how a baby feeds. But this is not doing well and taken to the operating room, doing better afterwards. So 90% improvement, I feel like that is good. It's more or less, I would have guessed around 85% just anecdotally. So I'm happy when the data, for whatever it's worth, is close to what I'm thinking. So it can be safe, it can be effective. We looked at the risks, you know, what happens in the operating room with these kids, because that is the big question. Should we be taking these kids and putting them under anesthesia again? I know one of my partners, mentors, Karen Zur, she does not do this, and she's a great laryngologist, and I have a lot of respect for what she does, and she has good reasons for not doing this, and you can talk to her about that. But we did have a patient who had some laryngospasm. We had another patient who needed some subglottic work who we ended up keeping a tube in for 12 hours, but both of those patients were included in the cohorts who actually had improvement in their diet post-surgery. I think there's a lot of people who really will question, when do you feel like, you know, you can inject? There's temporary injectables in kids who are very, very young. I a lot of times just use basically viscous water, which is otherwise Prolarin gel. It doesn't last that long. It lasts a month or so at the most. And slightly older kids, I will use hyaluronic acid. I do not use, Juvederm. I do not use the Prolarin Plus. I don't think that cement is forgiving. When kids are older and they need an injection, I'm oftentimes doing a reinnervation. I will sometimes put fat in the larynx. And I think that that's very forgiving and very effective. I also will, depending on where we feel like the injury took place, sometimes this will influence my decision as to when to pull the trigger on a more permanent intervention to the larynx. And I think one of the more permanent things that I do is, go in there and actually do an ANSA to recurrent reinnervation. And I did this primarily, for swallow function, although we do see improvements in voice, and in patients who've been injected for many years over and over again, really get away from needing those injections. And on objective voice and swallow data, they seem to really hold the course over many years. So I'm happy to say that. EMG, I think, is something that is also a much larger conversation. I've used it sparingly, I think. I think there's a lot of times when EMG can be used early on where it doesn't necessarily change what we're going to do, and it may actually give you some information that suggests the vocal fold is not coming back if you do it too early, wherein if you wait, you may see different data. So these kids who I'm doing reinnervation have usually had their cord out for a little while. I reinnervate them, I inject them, and then we follow them closely in the voice and swallow clinic. Other thing, work as a team. We work really close with our heart center. I rely on them. They rely on us. We have our airway group we try and be systematic about how we approach these kids. I can't be thankful enough for my partners, Kara and Karthik, who you probably all know. We have a swallow clinic, and our speech language pathologists really, as you heard from the initial lecture today, do the heavy lifting with the bedside care. And the OTs in the heart world are also very, very good. But they work with us in the outpatient clinic where we stay very, very close. And we do have inpatient consultation service with our air digestive team. And we have cardiothoracic surgeons who actually call us and instigate or initiate, I should say, air digestive inpatient consultation. So they're very helpful. Our team is now very, very big, and I'm really proud of our group and what they do to help us kind of push things when it comes to surgical management and swallow management for our heart kids. So thank you very much.
That's great. Thank you so much, Doug. So I think, you know, we've been talking all about the swallowing and trying to get kids eating early and doing these interventions, but we're not doing this in isolation. And certainly, I think that's one of the big questions that always comes up is, what are we doing to the lungs when we start working on this? So with that, you're up and running.
Yeah. Thank you. Even though it's Saturday, I'd like to welcome you all on your departure from Denver as the Chief of Pulmonary and Sleep Medicine here. So I'm glad you're here joining us. And I'm happy to be talking to you about this. I talk a lot about what happens in the CICU when we go to consult there, because these are very complicated patients in multiple different ways, not just up here, but down here. So I do have some disclosures here. I have a couple startups. I advise Boehringer Ingelheim on clinical trials and consult in that way. And I've been the editor of the Kendig, which is the primary pediatric pulmonary text. So when I think about this, I like to break down complex things and create mnemonics to help learners, especially when things are very complex. And so this is a mnemonic I use for congenital heart disease. I'm going to walk you through some of it. So we know that there's nerve problems. We know there's airway problems. We know there's pressure problems. We know there's parenchymal problems. And so with that, my sleep doctors are happy that I created this mnemonic called NAP. So maybe it's because some of our people are chronically sleep deprived, but the mnemonic is NAP. And with that, you can work through the problems that these patients can have in the CI. The CICU is very good about thinking about some of these problems. I almost never need to talk about pressure. They're all over pressure. And as mentioned here, a lot of people are thinking about the nerves. I will mention the phrenic nerve. If you have a diaphragmatic paralysis under 6 months of age, these patients are very difficult to get off the ventilator. Someone's going to talk about malaise, I assume, coming up. You've been talking about it in this conference, so I'm not going to talk about that. But I am going to talk about everything that's in purple because it impacts these patients. Swallow and inflammation and aspiration, you're going to talk about that here. But these are things that are frequently not thought about that your pulmonologist needs to think about. They can come to Aero Clinic because they can be missed. We just had a diagnosis, a PCD come up recently, and you'll see plastic bronchitis come up, and certainly a hypoplast clinic. So these are things you may not commonly think of, and your primary pulmonologist will be working through this, but heterotaxy is something that we think about. Most of the congenital heart disease patients will have a degree of heterotaxy, and I'll define that in a second. And primary ciliary dyskinesia can be associated with the cilia involved in the sinuses and the ears. We overlap with otolaryngology about that, down into the airways, so they can have sinus ear problems and bronchiectasis. And sometimes they can be hard to pick up with chronic cough. But you have to think about these kids in the Aero Clinic if they have chronic cough, and especially in congenital heart disease. These heterotaxies can take the form cardiac loop malformations, as you can see, abdominal organ asymmetry, which I'll show you, and malformation. So thinking about asymmetry, you can see dextrocardia, you can see times where you can have sinus ambiguous with the heart, you can see abdominal organs that are ambiguous in their position. These are all different forms of heterotaxy. And in one large study of PCD, you had 6.3% that had heterotaxy. And though it's a small percentage, there were congenital heart disease patients in this. So we do think about heterotaxy when you have a child who has chronic cough, may not be from aspiration, but it may be this. A recent child was diagnosed with PCD. One of our pulmonologists may be listening. Kid had aspiration. Kid was a heart disease kid. Kid had asthma-like symptoms. Fixed it. The cough didn't go away. So it's just something that we think about in pulmonary. just more evidence of this. There's PCD mouse model, 40% had congenital heart disease. And then if you look at those with congenital heart disease who had heterotaxy, there are significant p-values in those that have complications. So thinking about these heterotaxy patients, I think they deserve extra consideration. The pulmonologist is going to come in and think about how to clear mucus out, how to think about whether this could be a problem, and do genetic testing. Plastic bronchitis, again, these are in the airways. Plastic bronchitis, if you've ever seen it, again, otolaryngology and pulmonary overlap in this regard. Frequently, there's Fontan physiology. They can cough these casts up. You will see this. We now know it's a lymphatic flow disorder. Lymphatics are backing up and seeping into the airway. The casts in this situation are not inflammatory. You can have casts that are asthma related, but in this condition, they tend not to be inflammatory. Evaluations ultimately can lead to an MRI, lymphangiography, and now treatment can be done with lymphatic duct embolization at an experienced center. So those are other airway specific conditions that if you have an aspirating child that you may overlook that have to be thought about. And then in my little mnemonic, we think through these conditions because all of these things in NAP change the way you think about a patient. We're consulted in the CICU for out of proportion hypoxemia, out of proportion respiratory status. And yes, you could think about aspiration, but then there are these other conditions. If I teach you nothing today, I hope you leave with this picture in mind, because it's what the majority of kids in the CICU have as their underlying lung disease. This would be a biopsy that we have. We know from studies that we did, lung biopsy studies, imaging, and clinical correlation studies, a large study in 2007, 187 lung biopsies in children under two, which were out of proportion, felt to have interstitial lung disease. This was the most common biopsy in kids under two. And that and the surprising point of this growth abnormality, which is really alveolar simplification, these alveolar spaces are huge. There should be 100, if not more, alveolar sacs here. So you have a decreased ventilatory surface area that markedly impairs their ventilation capacity. And the surprising point, 65% had congenital heart disease of some type. When you add that with Down syndrome, a prematurity, the numbers were very, very high. So when we go into the CICU and it's out of proportion, we are seeing this image. You can call it hypoplasia. I hate that term because it's really alveolar simplification. And this allows the learner to understand this is a surface ventilation problem. It also impairs your vasculature. So many of these patients have pulmonary hypertension. So it's how the pulmonologist is going to be thinking about it. We can't predict outcome based on this degree of alveolar simplification. Sometimes we'll ask the heart surgeon to go ahead and grab some tissue if we really want to understand the complexity of the pathology. But frequently, this is what we find. So we don't always biopsy. So decreased surface area also complicates your physiology. If you're in the CICU, there's another condition called PIG, which we now know is a developmental disorder of the interstitium. There are clear cells in the interstitium, as you see here. These are cells that if you're on EM, you will find that they're full of glycogen and is full of lipid. These participate likely in the surfactant system, and we have not seen this on pathology past 14 months of age. So this is a developmental lung disorder, but it markedly increases the interstitium. These cells can proliferate, so these patients can get worse. And then over time, they have apoptosis. Steroids may drive that apoptosis, so your pulmonologist may be talking about steroids. But the big three here are also involved. Congenital heart disease, trisomy, and prematurity. They co-travel with growth abnormalities. And so now you have a diffusion defect. So when pulmonary comes for an out-of-proportion kid in the CICU, I'm thinking about aspiration, I'm thinking about nerve and airway, but frequently this is the diagnosis. If we really want to understand if PIG is present, we will get a CT scan. Our center did a study, and you'll see this ground glass with these cysts. The cysts are growth abnormality, and the ground glass opacity tends to correlate with PIG. It matters because steroids can markedly impact their ventilation, and you can actually make a big difference in their oxygenation fairly quickly with the trial of steroids. So These are things that a pulmonologist is thinking about that can change care in addition to aspiration, because all of these conditions complicate things. A growth abnormality, frankly, is more frequent than an aspiration event. And then you have lymphangiectasis. It's really a vascular disorder. Lymphatic abnormalities, lymphangiectasis, these are the lymph vessels. They encase the lungs. They're in the pleural space. The fluid goes up to the thoracic duct. And in lymphangiectasis, you get a dilation. They're normal vessels, but you get dilation because of backflow from chronic pulmonary venous obstruction. Usually see this in hypoplasts and total anomalous pulmonary venous return. So we're thinking about this because this can also impact your pleural status and give you pleural effusions. There are, again, CT scans, we do like imaging. CT scans can give us an understanding because the interstitium can be dilated with these dilated lymphatic channels. There could be primary and secondary cardiac disease. Again, hypoplastic lung heart syndrome can give you these lymphatic abnormalities. And can really complicate your care in the CICU. So congenital heart disease is complex. If you think about the mnemonic, you can carefully work through all these different things. Every one of those abnormalities really changes the care and how you think about those patients, how you think about their long-term morbidity. So we think about aspiration. I'm an aero and ILD doctor, so I think about that. But I also think about these conditions because it changes how we make recommendations in the CICU. So the lungs matter about aspiration, but some of these things can be addressed. Plastic bronchitis, lymphatic abnormalities can now be treated different ways. And so they're good to think about. So when you go to sleep tonight, think about NAP and review this mnemonic, okay? So you remember it better. All right, that's it.
Robin, that was great. And I think that it really just kind of hones in on some of these things like for us to think about. But one question I have is the role of lung biopsy. So we talk about this all the time, and it seems like we go on these runs where every kid who, you know, gets their chest open gets a lung biopsy, then we don't. And what is the role?
So I think that over time, first of all, we're not afraid of lung biopsies. I think lung biopsies, it's a good test if you can do it safely, if your pathologist can read the right pathology, and if you're going to do something about it. So in those situations, I think it's good. I think in young kids, the genetic abnormalities now, we can pick up genetic abnormalities where we may understand what the lung biopsy is going to show. I showed CT images so that you can find CT patterns that may limit your need for a biopsy.
Yeah.
So that's why with growth abnormalities and PIG, we now have a pattern that we think about before we would recommend it. However, if the heart surgeon is intent on, or the cardiac ICU is intent on us explaining more and proving why this is out of proportion, and they're going back to the OR, then we just said, grab a piece of tissue for us and we will see. But I'm not frequently recommending lung biopsies out of the CICU or the NICU as much anymore because of genetics. We tend to recommend it now in older kids for diagnosis and really for immune-mediated lung disease to look at the cell types.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. And I think it is one of those things where we sometimes get so tunnel vision on aspiration and we're so focused on swallowing that we sort of miss the rest of this. And so when, particularly depending on which team is rotating through, which team is deciding, you know, what the problem is, well, it must be aspiration. It must be. So you guys need to do something about that. So I'm sure I'm more than happy to go inject a vocal cord, but yeah. I think, you know, say putting that more thought process to it is hugely important. So I think, you know, it's like when I take like a look at all this sort of stuff, it's like these kids, you know, I think one beauty I think of, like when I think of the congenital heart population is, I always say, you know, they have a fixable problem. Like their hearts can be fixed. And so a lot of the stuff is kind of managing and working our way through this. And so when I sit back and like, look at it, it's like, versus, you know, we might be have like this ultra preemie in the NICU that's just, you're just going to keep sort of chipping away when it comes to things like feeding versus like, we can go get the heart repaired and then kind of move forward. So I think that these, you know, these kids do ultimately sort of become that perfect aerodigestive patient. So, you know, which is clearly what we do. So at this point, what I'd love to do is just kind of open it up to the floor and any questions that are out there.
Can you guys hear me? Okay. Thank you so much to everybody.
So there's one case report. Okay. So the question was related to steroid therapy for PIG and dosing and outcomes. So PIG is developmental lung disorder. And so if you're on a quarter, and so you have to really balance the risk benefits for this. If you are on a quarter liter of oxygen, nobody's treating with steroids, even for PIG, because it's not going to be that abundant. But if you have a child who's on significant ventilatory settings and getting them off or down decreases risk for this patient, or getting them off the ventilator, then I think it's a reasonable strategy because those risks are great also. So we may, there's one case report in the literature of a child that was biopsied and found to have PIG, treated with asthma-related doses, like 1 per kilo BID, then developed cardiac abnormality and rapidly improved with their oxygenation, developed a cardiac abnormality, went back to the OR, and the surgeon decided, let's just see what happened. That we can't decide that. We can't do things like that, but a surgeon can, I guess, when they're in there. Let's just see what happened with this. So biopsied them again. And then we did proliferation studies, and the paper did, and apoptotic studies. And what they showed is pre-steroids, those cells were proliferating. Post-steroids, this was like 20 days apart. There were huge apoptotic markers, and the interstitium was thinning. So there's the thinking that steroids drives apoptosis in these patients. But there are, so we might start like you, low doses. And if we don't get a response, then we might do a pulse. If they're going to respond, they're going to respond pretty fast. And if they respond, we don't keep giving them steroids and giving them steroids. And after 14 months, they don't have PIG anymore. No PIG. They have a growth abnormality if they're still symptomatic, and that's going to take a long time. So I get a lot of calls about PIG, and if somebody's calling me about a three-year-old with PIG, I'm like, sorry, they don't have PIG. They likely have a significant growth abnormality.
Great. Any other questions? I've got one for Doug. So there's a lot of discussion out there about doing nerve monitoring and trying to get the cardiac units to do that in different ways to go. Clearly the Boston group talks about that. And I think there are some cultures, some cardiac surgeons want to do it, some do not. Do you have any experience with that? Is that something you guys have discussed?
So I think the challenge of nerve monitoring comes in how you would do it and do it reliably. I think there's a lot of arguments that with an open chest on bypass pump for 14 to 24 hours, it's juice isn't worth the squeeze, and mm-hmm. that there's not good enough data, even in situations, for example, a very well-established thyroid center using nerve monitoring tube, which we know how that works. They sell them on the market already. In an experienced center, you may not have a huge difference in results. I'm not trying to start a different conversation, but I think that there's some truth there. Yeah. And if you're going to try and do a single nerve monitoring, for example, in an open chest, then there's a lot that goes into how your patient's anesthetized, how you're going to do that and still do the operation, and whether or not it's even worthwhile. I did a fellowship in biodesign where we were looking at all of these different options, and what I got out of that was not a patent or a job in industry. It was basically, I learned that there's not a great solution as it stands. However, there are groups that are looking into not necessarily monitoring the nerve, but making the nerve extremely visible. Mm-hmm. And I think that that has some promise.
Yeah. I agree. It's like one of these things that where, is the juice really worth the squeeze?
Yeah.
Because it's by the time you sort of on these little babies futzing around trying to get everything, even if you had the tubes to do it, like you say, even the best NIM tube, which we know sits in the right spot, things are going to be happening. And we know how much movement goes on during a cardiac surgery.
Yeah, but the reality also is that if you, when one of the benefits of an aerodigestive team or a team being involved in the pre-op discussions with families before they go into the heart room is knowing that this can happen. And I think that if it's a surprise to families afterwards, and, you know, like you mentioned, patients are, why can't I breastfeed my baby? Well, this is a risk of surgery. And just hearing that up front, I think is helpful. Knowing that there's a team that's going to manage post-op is also helpful. And in the heart world, it's probably not the biggest problem the child has. And I think that a lot of that dampens down the, now, you know, it's easy to inject, but again, it's not necessarily going to solve the problem for a lot of these kids. It's close care and close follow-up and making sure that you're not just playing whack-a-mole.
It's a piece of, one piece of a giant puzzle. Right. Well, if there are no other questions from the crowd, then we'll go ahead and conclude. I want to thank everyone. I think this is a wonderful panel. I appreciate your time.
Thanks.